Surf Explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if we thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Greetings, Surf Explorers. It's so good to be back with you this wonderful 2008. Here we go. X Squared Radio in our third year here on the BBS Radio Network. And, of course, we are streaming live on the SteelEye Media Network tonight as well. I can't tell you how much I appreciate the many hundreds of you that have signed up for our newsletter. We promise to fill that with great content this year. 2008, we're leading up to the 2012 end times prophecies many people have been looking for. Also, many ancient civilizations have left us signs and architectures to alert us to our possible destiny. We're going to discuss a little bit of that tonight. Tonight, we're going to have open lines the entire night. So right after the news here, we're going to open up the lines and cover some amazing Earth anomalies. These will be the subjects of further exploration this year. I also want to go over some very exciting information that we have discovered in the last 2 weeks. I think you should be awake at dawn and go outside and look at Venus and Jupiter. The two brightest planets are converging in the southeastern sky for a spectacular close-up encounter on February 1st. By the end of the month, the two planets will be so close together, you can hide them behind the tip of your index finger held at arm's length. That doesn't happen very often. It makes a spectacular show in the sky. And if you have binoculars, you can even get a very up-close view of the planets. Can't do that with stars, but you can with planets. It could be a good show. Also, the solar wind today is only 409.8 kilometers per second. I say only. That's about half scale. So we are streaming a pretty good solar wind tonight. However, the sun is blank with no sunspots today. We have entered the next solar cycle, number 24, so we will keep you informed of this. We expect to see the intensity of solar flares rise to the high X class. This means that high-altitude aircraft will be rerouted to lower the risk of exposure to harmful rays to below the Arctic Circle. And you might want to be aware that your cell phone and internet disruptions will be many. On January 10th, asteroid 2005 WJ56 will fly past Earth, only 2.6 million miles away. There's no danger of a collision, but the kilometer-wide space rock will be close enough for amateur astronomers to photograph as it glides through the constellation Taurus, glowing like an 11th magnitude star. That's pretty bright. We would just want to keep you informed of that so that you can stay aware. We also have some other asteroid news here in just a little bit. And a news article that came out in May, but I'm bringing it up again right now so that it will tie into this other rather strange anomaly that has come up. It starts like this. Alien crew is missing and still at large, warn scientists. The captain of a ship rammed an iceberg in the frigid waters of the Greenland Sea and found a perfectly preserved UFO frozen inside. What's more, the alien crew is missing and may still be at large. Scientists from all over the world have been summoned to an undisclosed location near the seacoast town of Scoresbysund, Greenland, to investigate the intact alien craft. The design and technology of this space capsule is years ahead of anything yet developed on Earth, says Dr. Gerd Stuber of Bern, Switzerland. He says it's definitely from another planet. The discovery occurred above the Arctic Circle between Norway and Greenland when a seismic exploration ship struck a huge floating iceberg at about 3 p.m. on May 24th. Damage to the ship was minor, but the collision knocked a large piece out of the iceberg, exposing part of a strange metal object. He says, my staff and I have examined every inch of it, and all the evidence indicates that the craft was manned by a crew of five beings who apparently lost control and crashed. However, we can find no trace of them. When the crew chipped away enough ice to get a good look at it, that metallic something turned out to be the hull of a UFO. No one is able to pinpoint exactly when the spaceship crash landed on Earth or how it became encased in an iceberg, and experts differ widely about the fate of the missing aliens and even when they might have crashed. Some speculate that the great blackout that hit the eastern seaboard was caused by a UFO crash. All we know is they're dead, says Juan Cordoba, noted Spanish biologist and member of Dr. Stuber's staff. Even if they survive the crash, there's no way they could stay alive in New York without being spotted. I'm not so sure about that. I think aliens could survive just fine on the streets of New York without even being spotted. Also, some good questions that might be asked about this is why the Arctic Circle? Do UFOs frequent the Arctic Circle? I know if I was visiting a planet, I probably would not want to land in Central Park. I would not want to land somewhere where I knew U.S. military or any other military organization would be probing me and prodding me and walking all over my campsite. I would want to go someplace where few humans, if any, are found, especially in the wintertime. And by the way, the Arctic winter is not over in May. So a nice place to hide. If a ship did become disabled, it would be quite possible for it to become encased in ice. Whether now or thousands of years ago, global warming might have just bobbed it out so that this ship could find it. Interesting how all this plays into the upcoming North Pole Inner Earth expedition. We have a segment of that that has sort of an Indiana Jones air to it, and a documentary could be forthcoming. Along that news also, several dozen people in Stephenville, Texas, including a pilot, county constable, and business owners, insist they have seen a large, silent object with bright lights flying low and fast. Some are seeing fighter jets chasing it. People wonder what in the world it is, because this is the Bible Belt, and everyone is afraid it's the end of times, says Steve Allen, a freight company owner and pilot, who said the object he saw last week was a mile long and half a mile wide. It was positively, absolutely nothing from these parts, he says. While federal officials insist there's a logical explanation, locals swear that it was larger, quieter, faster, and lower to the ground than an airplane. They also said the object's lights changed configuration, unlike those of a plane. People in several towns who reported seeing it over several weeks have offered similar descriptions of the object. Machinist Ricky Sorellis said friends made fun of him when he told them he saw a flat metallic object hovering about 300 feet over a pasture behind his Dublin home. But he decided to come forward after reading similar accounts in the Stephenville Empire Tribune. Sorellis said he'd seen the object several times. He said he watched it through his rifle's telescope lens and described it as very large and without seams, nuts, or bolts. Officials at the region's two Air Force bases, Dyess in Abilene and Shepherd in Wichita Falls, also said none of their aircraft were in the area last week. The Air Force no longer investigates UFOs. Yeah. A little bit more asteroid news. This is when it was just recently observed, so I want you to pay close attention to this. The largest asteroid to come near the Earth in more than 20 years will make its closest approach on Tuesday, venturing as close as 1.4 lunar distances from Earth. Now, for those of you that don't know what a lunar distance is, the moon sits out there approximately 250,000 miles. So we're talking 1.4 times that. My goodness, folks, we're talking about 400,000 miles. You can almost throw a rock that far. Already, observations of the space rock reveal it may have formed from two separate asteroids that fell together and stuck. The asteroid, named 2007 TU-24, was discovered by the Catalina Sky Survey in Arizona on 11 October 2007. Based on its apparent brightness, astronomers estimate that it was between 150 and 600 meters wide. That's a little over a quarter of a mile, but it isn't too far away for ground-based telescopes to resolve it and determine its actual size and shape. Just wanted to let you know that there was a small asteroid that was headed for Mars, and I think it had a 1 in 25 chance of hitting Mars. No news on that yet, but the interesting thing and the alarming thing about this was it was discovered only 3 weeks before these calculations were made. Now, many of you might let that pass and say, oh, gee, that's interesting. But the gist of the article was that if Earth discovered that we had a collision with a small asteroid, even something 1,000 yards across, would certainly play havoc with populated areas and would make quite a splash if it landed in an ocean, which could make a very nice tsunami in every direction. The problem is that with that little bit of notice, there isn't anything we could do about it. The The only thing that we might be able to do is predict where it's going to land and say it's time to jump in the Winnebago and head to parts further away from ground zero. Interesting. We don't have any defense measures whatsoever on this planet that can stop even a small rock from coming down. We're spending our money on other things. Want to let you know that tonight on X Squared Radio, we are going to have open phone lines. So those of you that are listening all over the world, it doesn't matter what time for the next 3 hours, you can call in here toll-free, U.S. 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. And in Canada, we've got a toll-free number for you as well. We have many, many listeners up there. 877-489-6350. And anywhere else on planet, off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us. Now, this is not toll-free, but many of you have free long distance anyway, or if you're going to call in and make a 1 or 2 minute comment, it will be well worth it tonight. You have your opportunity. The number, we have three of them, 530-776-5154, 530-776-5185, and 530-776-9916. We also provide, for those listeners who have Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio, or if you are using PalTalk, you can reach us at BBSRadio_com. So you can reach us any of those ways. We are not running our Instant Messenger or AOL Instant Messenger tonight. Do not have the two computers running, so I am not able to handle all that input. I can only push so many buttons and turn so many knobs, so if you want to reach us tonight, I promise nobody at X Squared Radio has ever been attacked. So you can call in with anything you like, any questions you like. We are going to provide a North Pole Inner Earth Expedition update tonight. And we have some fantastic news on discoveries made in the last 2 weeks. And we're going to cover those in detail tonight. I think you'll find it interesting. We have 3 hours tonight, so if you're not getting all 3 hours of X Squared Radio, you need to contact us. Just contact me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. Give me the call letters of your radio station and we'll take care of the rest. We want to make sure that you get all 3 hours. And we really appreciate your feedback on the podcast section that we've added to the website at x2-radio.com. We have made a habit of the latest shows taking a choice hour of that show and putting it up there on the podcast for free. Now, this sort of gives you a very excellent 55 minutes with our guest, but it doesn't give you the entire show. And we hesitate to call it a show. We call it a program here. These artists, authors, scientists, researchers are serious about their work, and we're serious about interviewing them and getting to the highest and deepest levels of science that can be reached with an interview. And we read all the books that our authors and researchers send us, unlike many shows who rely on a program manager or ask the guest to send in 40 questions that the host might ask them. I didn't originate in the broadcast industry, and I don't know any other way. We try to do the scientific method as much as we can here. And because we have done that, we have risen to the fastest growing talk radio program in North America, and we are fast expanding in Europe and also Australia. We have shipped a box load of books in the past few weeks to Australia. One other item of news, and this is kind of interesting. More news from Greenland. I'm going to cover a little bit more of that here in just a second, because One item that has made it, and this is out of the Associated Press, I'm sure you've heard it on your local news, but we're going to cover a little different aspect here, something that the reporter forgot to mention in the article. And this is from Washington AP. A large U.S. spy satellite has lost power and could hit the Earth in late February or early March, government officials said Saturday. That's yesterday. The satellite, which no longer can be controlled, could contain hazardous materials, and it is unknown where on the planet it might come down, they said. Now, of course, these are not the main concerns of the U.S. government and those who built the satellite. You're going to hear something that might open your eyes a little bit here. The officials spoke on condition of anonymity because the information is classified as secret. It was not clear how long ago the satellite lost power or under what circumstances. In other words, they don't know if it was shot down or if it was beamed with something or if some other force disabled it. And quote, appropriate government agencies are monitoring the situation, said Gordon Jandro, a spokesman for the National Security Council. The National Security Council, talking about satellites. Anyway, they're monitoring the situation after it was disclosed by other officials. Quote again, numerous satellites over the years have come out of orbit and fallen harmlessly. We are looking at potential options to mitigate any possible damage this satellite may cause, close quote. Now, the issue here is they have no control of the satellite. There are no rockets that they could fire to let it fall harmlessly in the sea. This is an out-of-control, 20,000-pound metal object. Got the picture? We are looking at potential options to mitigate any possible damage this satellite might cause, he says. He would not comment on whether it is possible for the satellite to perhaps be shot down by a missile. He said it would be inappropriate to discuss any specifics at this time. Of course not. Now, here is what I want you to pay attention to. The spacecraft contains hydrazine, which is rocket fuel. Now, that's actually a dry fuel. What they do is they inject it into a catalyst, a lot like the catalyst on your car, and it spontaneously vaporizes, creating thrust. So they can carry lots and lots of thruster fuel for years and years' supply with very little dry hydrazine. And this is according to a government official who was not authorized to speak publicly, but spoke on condition of anonymity. Hydrazine, a colorless liquid with an ammonia-like odor, is a toxic chemical and can cause harm to anyone who contacts it. Yes, I know, we use hydrazine in our backpacks for fuel underneath our camping stoves. It's only hazardous if you concentrate it in a sock and put it over your head. That's not the concern either. We'll get to the guts of this here in just a second. Such an uncontrolled re-entry could risk exposure of U.S. secrets, said John Pike, a defense and intelligence expert. Spy satellites typically are disposed of through a controlled re-entry into the ocean so that no one else can access the spacecraft, he said. Jeffrey Richelson, a senior fellow with the National Security Archive, said the spacecraft likely is a photo reconnaissance satellite. Notice the word likely, and this is the National Security Archive, acting as though he really doesn't know what's in the satellite. Such eyes in the sky are used to gather visual information from space about adversarial governments and terror groups, including construction at suspected nuclear sites or militant training camps. The bottom line is, they don't really care whether it strikes in the middle of a trailer park somewhere, although they could probably say, we're sorry, lost control of that one, hated to see that happen. We'll take care of any families affected. But, by the way, don't pick up any of that camera equipment. We want to recover all of it. Wouldn't want anyone to know how closely they can count the number of hairs on your forearm hanging out the window of your car 80 miles an hour. wouldn't want anyone to know how well they can read license plates from 200 miles up. So it's more the technology than it is public safety that's concerned here. And I can assure you that the satellite was designed to last a lot longer than it did. Something shortened the life of that satellite. Quite interesting. We'll have some more news at the beginning of the next hour. Let's talk a little bit about what we're going to talk about last night. The last 2 weeks we ran archives out of our best of categories. Last week we had William Henry on the program. I thought it would be appropriate to cover some of those discoveries on this program tonight. You are about to learn of something so amazing that Egyptians have formed an entirely new division of security to control it. The Office of Security and Antiquities supplies armed guards to prevent anyone from venturing too closely or digging up anything in Egypt. Now, the last 2 weeks, William Henry and a small group were in Egypt. I have been in close communication with him. There are the normal tourist places where you can go, pyramids and the Sphinx and Dendera and different places like that, but very few people know about an even more ancient site. In fact, there are two of them I'm going to talk about this hour. The first is a structure that's called the Osirian. Now, you might have heard about this in a book or two, and I'm not saying that since, say 1965 or so, that a few tourists here and there have casually walked by this structure. But few of them, if any, have been physicists or have been chemists or have been engineers and have been able to appreciate the grandeur and the design scope of the Osirian and possibly what it could be used for. There is a researcher, an English woman, who traveled to Abydos, which is a temple built near the Osirian, practically right on top of it. Her name is, well, her original name was Dorothy Eddy. Her name was changed shortly after she turned 52 to Om Seti. Om Seti means mother of Seti. Seti the first was king of Egypt and knew about the Osirian. Now, the Osirian, Seti I was in the 16th dynasty of Egypt, somewhere around the time of Christ. But the Osirian had existed for some 9,500 years prior to that. Yeah, you heard me. 9,500 years prior to that. Seti discovered, either through research, rumor, or legend, that the Osirian existed and went looking for it. When he found it, he decided to build his temple practically on top of it. In fact, it is the only L-shaped temple in Egypt, and it is precisely positioned to corner the Osirian. Now, the Osirian is a rather fantastic construction. All of it exists under the surface of the Egyptian sands. They have been dug out, and this has been excavated to the point where you can actually walk down inside of it, except for a layer of about 6 inches of algae-laced water and some sludge. You can appreciate the design of this. Now, it is made entirely out of polished, highly machined red granite. And that red granite was quarried 300 miles north of Abydos. That's not the fantastic part. The fantastic part is the small blocks were 20 tons. The large blocks were over 200 tons. 200 ton single blocks of polished red granite. First of all, that's hard to quarry with Bronze Age tools. Second of all, It's impossible to lift, given Bronze Age technology. I was talking with Hani Zaime, who's the archaeologist. He's now 91 years old, who worked with Om Seti for years and wrote a book, Om Seti's Egypt, which we're going to give you an opportunity to get that book at Amazon.com. You need to get that book. It's so well written, and it does tell a lot of the story. I can tell you that Hani was a thoroughly amazing interview face-to-face, and he told me that the Osirian was definitely very ancient and existed a long time before Seti, and he didn't know how Seti knew where it was located. But it was clear one of several things was true. Either Seti was so impressed with the design and scope of and purpose of the Osirian, and we're going to discuss that here in a second, that he decided to build a temple near it, hoping that the original designers would return and share more information with him. There's more to the story, I guarantee you that. Because inside Abydos, on the walls, is something so fantastic, so amazing. And it ties in with other cultures, the intent of other cultures, so well that you're gonna find this completely fascinating. So let's find out, what is the Osirian? It is not a place of worship, I can tell you that. One of the engineering ideas that early archaeologists said, well, the Egyptians had unlimited manpower, so they could bring 1,000 men, if that's what it would take, to lay hands on this block and lift up and move it into position. I said, well, that sounds reasonable, except let's do a little bit of math. How much weight can the average Egyptian carry, say, 30 feet, 100 feet? Well, it came out to about 100 kilos. That's about 225 pounds. That's a lot of weight. I've carried 225 pounds, and I'm much bigger than the average Egyptian. I don't think I could carry 225 pounds much further than 100 feet. But let's just assume that it is the maximum weight. So you take an Egyptian and you put his hands, palms up, underneath this 200-ton block of granite, and you slide in another Egyptian, and another one, and another one, shoulder to shoulder, all the way around this 80-foot-long, 4-foot-by-4-foot polished column of granite, and you lift. Oops, there's one problem. You're about 7,000 Egyptians short of being able to pick up the block. No rope, no wood, and at that time they didn't even have steel. There is no possible way that block could have been lifted into position 16 feet above the granite slabs underneath it on columns, let alone transported 300 miles from Aswan, where it was quarried, all the way down to Abydos, which is a good ways from the Nile. That's the first problem. The second problem is, once it is designed, once it's all put together, it is built next to a very unique aquifer, that is a spring. The spring delivers an energized water, like an artesian well, but this water has ions in it. These ions distributed in 30-foot-deep columns, or 30-foot-deep pits that are machined into the granite. They're about 6 feet by 4 feet and 30 feet deep. They probably contain the water. Inside those, by design, or probably bimetal strips, and the granite is used as the dielectric to increase the electric potential. Based on the size and the volume of this and the amount of red granite in position, the Osirian was probably capable of generating about 4 megawatts. That's 4 million watts of electricity. That's enough to run a small town. 4 megawatts. Now, what would not the Egyptians, long before Egypt ever became Egypt, long before the first pharaoh ever showed up, the Osirian was in full operation. Doing what? We don't know. What we do know is the Osirian is no longer intact. The working parts of it have long since been removed. And the granite that once was polished, carefully laid in place, solid, one piece of granite, well designed, has been blown apart like it had an atom bomb inside of it. And we're not talking about dynamite. We're not talking about ordinary explosives. There was no carbon impregnation. There were no burns on this granite. There was either a massive power feedback or the original builders did not want to leave it intact when they left. There were multi-ton granite blocks as well as small parts of granite blown hundreds of feet in every direction around Abydos. Some of the granite was picked up by locals and used in other construction in Abydos. After all, it's a rare, raw material from 300 miles away, and it's pretty hard. Now, I'm going to bring up another structure toward the end of this hour, probably another 10 minutes or so, that ties into this, because this red granite is used in several other operations and suffered a similar fate. So what was SETI thinking of when he built Abydos, and what is it that he built over the Osirian? If you go inside Abydos and you look on the walls, there are amazing hieroglyphs, absolutely amazing. Abydos is not on the normal tourist trek. In fact, you have to go through at least two military, I'm talking the antiquities police, you have to go through two military checkpoints to get there. You don't just jump in a cab. You don't just jump on a bus. Your bus has to be part of an approved government convoy. That convoy has to be scheduled in advance and approved at the highest levels. And if it arrives early or arrives late, you're in big trouble. If your bus misses that convoy or somehow gets delayed or pulls away from that convoy, you are not allowed to pass. This is highly regulated, highly monitored, and it's not casual. I'm talking AK-47s and elevated towers aimed at these checkpoints. It is extremely well regulated. So if you make your way to Egypt, join one of these tours and make your way out to Abydos, you're going to see one of the most incredible temples and one of two locations where this particular device is depicted on the walls. This device is immensely important. The discovery was made by William Henry, and if you want to go to his website, it's williamhenry.net, not williamhenry.com. That will give you some photographer's website. Go to williamhenry.net, and you can find out more about it. Definitely covers it in his books and DVDs. And if he is speaking in your area, you need to get down there and see him live, because he is not one of these lecturers or presenters that is on a crusade or has some mystery school or some healing thing that he does. He is an Egyptian mythologist, and he gives you the facts, something I really admire about good research like that, and he doesn't throw anything out. What was SETI building? He was building what William Henry calls the Osiris device. Now, if you look up the term device, William says it doesn't necessarily mean a device like a lathe or a gamma spectrometer. It can be a symbol. and a symbol can be designed to excite something in a human being, to raise his consciousness, to change his DNA, to excite some spiritual experience within the person. Such could be a device, of course, of course. Same reason we wear crosses around our necks as Christians. Such a device, symbol, inspires us to walk a certain path and treat one another with perhaps more dignity and more tolerance. Such might have been the Osiris device, but this device, when looked at from an engineering standpoint, and when compared to the hieroglyphic explanation of what the device can do, and according to Om Seti's book, Om Seti's Egypt, was capable of doing, now you have quite a different viewpoint. The Osiris device, the central core of it is a what appears to be a gold shaft about 6 inches in diameter and about 40 feet tall. At the top of the gold shaft is an umbrella, or what looks like a palm tree at the top. Now, this is depicted with blue stones all over it on the hieroglyph on the wall at Abydos. But that very well could be sapphires, as is used in the stupa of Tibet, or it could represent plasma, an electric field, a visual corona that's developing around it as it's charged up. The umbrella could be made of multiple metals, platinum, gold, silver. Many of these things, when charged with a mild amount of static electricity, become incredible collectors. Incredible collectors. Much more powerful, or just as powerful, as a Van de Graaff generator. Those of you that don't know what a Van de Graaff generator is, it was a turn of the century, and I'm talking 19th century technology, used to collect static electricity on large copper balls raised up in the air, insulated from the ground by wooden poles or wooden columns. The electrons were built up on the copper balls by moving large fabric belts on a conveyor up to the copper ball and then back down to the ground. What happened was the static built up on the copper ball to the tune of several million volts. We're talking 200, maybe 300 million volts. When you get close enough to that, with a grounding probe, you get a large arc, like a lightning bolt. Tesla demonstrated similar technology by using coils to amplify AC and DC signals from small amounts of voltage with sizable amperage to large amounts of voltage with very little amperage. The effect on the human body was not harmful, but was quite dramatic. At the World's Fair, and I'm thinking this is 1905, it might be 1910, Edgar Rice Burroughs was at the World's Fair, and so was Tesla, giving a demonstration of his Tesla coil and his Tesla technology, and so was one Samuel Clemens, also known as Mark Twain. Tesla volunteered Mark Twain to stand on the platform and let Tesla turn the machine on. If you have ever seen photographs of Samuel Clemens' hair, you'll know right away that the audience got quite a view of what static electricity could do to Samuel Clemens. But it also had another effect, because the ELF, the extremely low frequencies, harmonized into the human body by Tesla's technology, caused Mark Twain to soil himself. He embarrassedly went to the restroom to clean up after the demonstration. All of this was reported by Edgar Rice Burroughs. So many people have been fascinated by large, seemingly harmless discharges of electricity. And although Tesla applied these in various ways, many of which we're rather curious about and are the subject of much paranormal lore right now, they can be focused and can be used for rather amazing results. Such was the design of the OSIRIS device by SETI the First. Now, the interesting thing about the OSIRIS device, as it builds up charge, on the walls is also depicted a stylized wormhole. Yes, that's correct. It looks like a boat, because that's a good image for them to use, but at the either end of the boat is a funnel, a lotus, an opening, the entrance to the wormhole. Every single time this is depicted on the walls, it has the head or body or torso of a traveler. Sometimes it's Horus, the hawk-headed god. Sometimes it's Isis. Sometimes it's OSIRIS. At the Temple of Abydos, on a regular basis, they had, during Christ's early days, when he was a youth in Egypt after they had fled Bethlehem, if you believe the Luke chapter 2 story that Christ was born in Bethlehem, actually the original translation is City of Bread, which also is Abydos. Anyway, Christ Jesus, the boy, would have witnessed an annual passion play at Abydos, where priestesses, young women who are kept clean and trained to play the part of Isis in the OSIRIS passion play, where the immaculate birth, the sinless life, and the resurrection of OSIRIS is rehearsed. Interesting. Interesting. We know this story, do we not? In any case, what we have here is a device that is tied into a wormhole. And when the device is charged up, and it's focused just right, and it's handled by trained technicians with the right consciousness, one can toggle between worlds. While this was going on, who knows, 9500 BC, hard to tell, but certainly during SETI's time, 16th dynasty of Egyptian history. Prior to this, the Tibetans were building the stupa, a 60-foot-tall version made out of 4,300 pounds of gold with over 10,000 jewels on it. Jewels, I mean gems, I mean crystals, perhaps tuned or chosen for certain frequencies, positioned in certain places on the stupa. There is a photograph of this. There is only one photograph of this, and it was taken by me last year in April. And when that photograph was brought back to the United States and overlaid with a Tesla coil, the match was perfect. And you can see this for yourself if you order the DVD, The Inner Earth Expedition Part 1. Not want to make a shameless commercial here in the middle of a monologue, but I do want you to know that you can view this for yourself. Just go to x2-radio.com, go to the online store and order a copy. $20 if you like Discovery Channel, you're going to love this documentary. In any case, we have two different pieces of technology from two different civilizations. One in the 7th century, one some 700 years before that, trying to accomplish the same thing, to open a stargate, to open a wormhole, to connect two different periods of time, to bring the future to here, to bring the past to here, and to be able to send certain individuals far through space-time, and it required power. And the Osirian, this ancient technology, probably the most ancient technology design on Earth discovered yet. The answers to these questions, who built the Osirian, how did they build it, cannot be answered. The best archaeologists in the world who lived there, who worked there, who studied it every single day, every week of their lives, still have no answers, especially if they try to compare it to the history that has been taught to us since we were kids. Man has only been on the earth for 6,000 years. Blah, 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 blah. Maybe so, but there were other races as advanced as us or better that lived here as well. By the way, I asked the question of John Riley, who is a great engineer, has a website, zeropointresearch.com, and is in the inventor and producer of the Lifestream Generator. We're going to talk about that in our next hour. On this particular trip, the question was asked, why granite? If they're so advanced, why don't they build it out of steel or platinum or gold or something? Why granite? Well, it's reported that John quickly came up with the answer, you don't get it. We've done experiments on this. All kinds of materials. Granite is by far the greatest amplifier dielectric for static electricity there is. There's one material that provides a second, almost a harmonic to this, and that is alabaster. And that brings us to our next site. We're going to talk to you about the most amazing piece of technology left behind by an ancient civilization. It is remote. It is definitely not on the tourist track. Believe me, the stories of how they got access to this and how they got pictures of this and how they were able to study this are going to amaze you. You're going to be very, very thankful that there are men like William Henry and John Riley and Melissa, also a good archaeologist, very well versed in Egyptian lore and hieroglyphics, that they had access to this, and they are able to bring these reports back so that we can talk about it on X Squared Radio. We are going to have William back on the program in a couple of weeks, and we're going to try to get John to come on next week and give us an update from his experience at these sites. And we may be able to get Melissa to come on as well, although it's more difficult to get these people who are world travelers and great researchers to take the time out to come on X Squared Radio. Don't forget that our phone lines are open all 3 hours, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, make sure to give us the call letters of your station, and we'll take care of the rest. Let me make sure, here we are at the end of the first hour, if you're listening to this while you're at your workstation, it's too late. You can only do this live. You can call in anywhere in the U.S. at 888-228-4494. Anywhere in Canada, toll-free, 877-489-6350. And anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us. This number is 530-776-5154 or 530-776-5185 or 530-776-9916. And those of you that are using Skype, great service out there, you can reach us at BBS Radio. And if you're using the newer PAL Talk, you can reach us at BBSRadio_com. We are not, unfortunately, running our instant messenger tonight because it pings in so fast and creates such a drain on the bandwidth. that it takes two computers to keep up with that, and we don't have the second one hooked up tonight, but we will next week, so stay tuned. 1 hour of X Squared Radio in the can, and the next hour we are going to cover Abu Ghraib. Abu means city of. This is not far. It's about 1,200 meters from Abu Sir, which is a rather interesting place as well. We may discuss that a little bit. But we want to make sure that you stay tuned and that you enjoy the content. We will most definitely have a fantastic year. We've got goals that we're going to reach with guests from all over the world, and 2008 is beginning an era as we get ready for the 2012 events. As we do that, this is the place to get the latest news. We cover it from a scientific standpoint, not too much woo-woo. We don't do conspiracy theories, and we don't do ghost stories. There are other programs that do that. We cover the scientific ends of things from a scientific viewpoint, and we will open your minds and expand your imagination beyond what you think you can assimilate. My AccuWindow forecast coming from Odessa, Washington is snow. Snow, snow, and more snow. It's about 19 degrees outside and snowy. We'll be back after these messages, so don't go away. This is X Squared Radio, bringing you the best from the past and the future. And we'll be back after these messages. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They've come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, that all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio.
Life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
Welcome back, explorers, to X Squared Radio. Where the past meets the future. We're beginning hour two here, coming to you live from Eastern Washington State in the small town of Odessa, where our AccuWindow forecast is snow. In fact, I did a lot of flying the last couple of weeks, and coming to here from Detroit, I noticed that just about the entire country is covered in snow. I imagine our albedo is quite high right now. How much of the sun's energy is reflected back out into space should make for a very interesting summer. In the news, samples, hang on a second here, we've got to go up one, here we go. Samples of Comet Wild 2 suggest it is made of rocky material like an asteroid rather than the fluffy dust expected of a comet. The object may be a refugee that formed in the asteroid belt before getting kicked to the chilly fringes of the solar system, or it might have formed in that frigid realm from material thrown out of the inner solar system, scientists say. NASA's Stardust mission, swung by Comet Wild 2 in 2004 to capture particles shed by the 5-kilometer object and return them to Earth, in 2006. We remember that as it kind of zipped through the atmosphere and smacked into the sand in Utah, and they were able to recover the gel-like material that's used to collect that. Since then, scientists have been carefully analyzing the microscopic fragments it collected. Early on, scientists found surprising evidence that Wild 2 contained some material from the inner solar system that had been heated to more than 1,000 degrees C due to its proximity to the sun. Now, scientists have been surprised again, as further study suggests, Wild 2 is made mostly of material from the inner solar system and that the object has a composition more like that of an asteroid than what was expected of a comet. Collectors inside this collection satellite are pieces of a lightweight silicon-based material called aerogel. The team's experiments show that GEMS, these are the shortcut, the acronym for the gel, like clumps, can be produced when other kinds of particles hit the aerogel at high speed, as they did in the Stardust collection process, and partially melt it as a result. Bolstering this idea is the fact that the Stardust gems have a different chemical signature from the gems in comet dust collected in Earth's atmosphere. Now, the interesting thing about that is that the dust is collected in Earth's atmosphere. Earth actually goes through the tails from these comets, and the dust sifts down through our atmosphere, lands in our biosphere, be it water or be it soil, and becomes part of our ecology. This may be how microscopic life reached Earth originally. Interesting. So this hour, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about, we talked about last hour about Abydos and about the Osirian in Egypt. The Osirian being a piece of ancient technology, 9500 BC, discovered by Seti I in the 16th dynasty of Egypt, contemporary to the boyhood of Jesus. And Seti builds a temple in Abydos, directly adjacent to the Osirian, actually an L shape. And if you're talking about the little pocket in the L there, the little right angle containment, that's where the Osirian sits. Now, the Osirian was not in working condition. That is to say, it wasn't generating the 4 megawatts that it's estimated it could generate when it was originally designed and in good working condition. But perhaps Seti thought there might be enough residual power to run his Osiris device, and perhaps he thought that the original builders might come back, and this would be a place they would come, and he would be interested in making contact with them so he could learn how to power his Osiris device and open a stargate. Well, there are other materials that are needed, other metals.
Hello?
One of them is gold. I believe we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Good evening, Dr. Agnew. This is Jared, or better, you know me better as Lupin is Burning.
Oh, how are you, Lupin?
Hi, how you doing, Dr. Agnew? Sorry to interrupt your great Egyptology lecture, or whatever you call it.
No interruption at all, my friend.
First hour was very interesting. And I just figured I'd call in because I haven't spoken to you since the new year, and you're always saying to call in when you have open lines, and it's a quiet night tonight, so I figured I'd call in during the second hour.
Fantastic. I'm glad you called in. What's on your mind?
I don't know. A lot of things. New year is very interesting. I don't know if I'm going to take your show in a different direction than you were going with the Egyptology.
That's what we're all about. My monologue stimulates a thought process in your mind, and you have a rather unique gift of sort of being able to pick up on other information and other intelligences that might be, let's call it channeling in. So you might be able to help us a little bit. What are we discovering here?
One thing I just wanted to mention about the channeling thing is everybody is like that. I'm sure you've read tons of science journals and all the stuff that comes out on the internet and magazines, and you know how they say, our brain, the thoughts don't come from the brain. Our brain is like a transmitter. And so everyone picks up things off of everybody and whatever's around them, energy sources, positive, negative, conscious, unconscious, natural, unnatural. I don't know.
Well, maybe I'm a channeler in denial.
Everyone's a channeler. Anyone that can pick pen and paper and make a doodle is a channeler. I mean, what you're channeling, I don't know, but you're definitely channeling something.
Channeling from where?
From your own conscious, your higher self, whatever you want to call it, your spirit, your soul, past lives, future lives. Extraterrestrials, spirits, you know what I'm saying? Anything.
I wish I had a better tuner, because it kind of all comes in as a big jumble. And I don't know if it's my thoughts or, you know, I need a tuner to be able to say, oh, yes, this is an off-world thought that's coming in from the Pleiades, or this is from a past life that I had 10,000 years ago, or this is from my long-lost sister.
You should develop your intuition. That's usually what I use to discern what's coming in. You have to listen to that voice in your head, and the first thing that pops in, without doubt, you have to take that and work with it. I'm sure you do that all the time. You're an engineer, right?
Yeah, that's very interesting how that happens. You don't really know how it happens, how you figure out how a machine works, or how you figure out the answer to that engineering problem. It just sort of pops in your head. People think you're a genius, and actually you're just a bystander saying, oh, well, yeah, just move it 15 degrees and that'll fix it. Turns out that it does, and they come back and say, how did you know that? Would you like a raise? Yes, I'll take the raise, and I don't know how I knew that.
What's it called? Everybody, I'm sure everybody is feeling that lately with New Year energy is very, very powerful. I'm sure many of us are waking up and if you've watched the news lately, the world's waking up. I think I read something on peace talks in Iraq today, so we're definitely going somewhere.
Well, let me ask you a question. If we can channel as receivers, can we channel as transmitters?
Transmitters, you mean to send out?
Yeah, in other words, can we send out?
That's the concept of telepathy, sharing, mass conscious, group mind, whatever you want to call it. Everybody shares like that. Empathists, telepaths, clairvoyants, everyone that picks something up is picking it up from somewhere. It doesn't come from nowhere. It's duality of everything, binary, you know, on and off, receive, send.
If there was a design or if there was a strategy, let's say a news organization wanted to create a negative energy consciousness wave across the country, and they wanted to play a negative story over and over and over again, say every 30 minutes, 24 hours a day.
That technology has been in use since before the Cold War. I was watching some documentary on the Cold War the other day, and the technology, I think Tesla technology, and they were talking about this thump that was coming out in the late 80s, I think it was, with the Soviets were playing this frequency, and I forget the name, I'm really bad with all that stuff, but it was basically just a frequency they played over and over again, and if you put on the transmitter and you put on the receiver at the right frequency, you'd hear it, and they did experiments, and they played on somebody who, you know, they put you in a room and put it on your headphones, and you listen to that and you can get sick. Or I actually have a program I run on my computer when I meditate, and it plays frequencies. It plays a Schumann's frequency. It plays frequencies of delta conscious, you know, delta, theta, alpha brainwaves. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Right.
Different states of consciousness. You can do that by playing frequencies straight into your brain. Like I said, your brain is a receiver. So anything that can be, any frequency that can be transmitted to your brain can be, well, hopefully, if you have the conscious capacity to comprehend it.
Well, I guess what I'm talking about here is a little bit of responsibility. If we individually are receivers and we're receiving everything from everywhere and we're discerning that or using our own powers of discernment to decide what's good and what's bad, what should we act on and what should we not act on, what should we dwell on with our thoughts and what should we tune out, perhaps we have some responsibility as transmitters that I can meditate and I can send out a positive message. I can send out a message of peace. I can send out a message of enlightenment.
That's a really popular school of thought that we're getting into as a race or as a humanity. What's it called? I'm not particularly fond of it, but it's really popular. Kind of the secret, and you talk about I even use the metaphor that you use. When you send the frequency out into the universe and it sends it back, who do you think is getting it and sending it back to you? You know what I'm saying? There's someone out there that you're connected to, and we're all connected to. I mean, even the hermit up in the mountains, you know, he's sitting there with himself, with the trees and the nature, and he's picking up on it. And then monks, they do this. They meditate, and they converse with the mass conscious of the planet, and that you can go up in the mountains. I'm sure you've been there, and you can talk to the monks, and they'll tell you exactly what's going on a mass conscious level.
Technological jump. To say to people, take some responsibility on what you send out. Let's just cut back on the backbiting and the gossip and the "I wish so and so was dead" or "why don't we go nuke them" kind of idea. And why don't we have responsibility here? If we're transmitters into this overall channeling mass information, then we should be sending out a mass consciousness of peace and progress.
Peace and love and all that other stuff. I'm not really a love and light messenger, but I do agree with the message. Yeah, definitely. A great metaphor for it, and I'm not sure this has been said a million times, is the internet. The internet is a great metaphor for the mass conscious. And
well, it boils down to this.
A product of what you do with it.
Yeah, it boils down to, do you want to add to the constructive interference of the human condition, or do you want to add to the destructive interference of the human condition? In other words, we have got prophetic words that have been written long ago that tell us we are marching inexorably toward a condition called Armageddon. We're going to wipe each other out. We're going to nuke each other into annihilation. And we have no choice. We're going to march toward this, And
that's a load of crap. We're done with the Armageddon. We're ready for the apocalypse, which is much more different. And that's what's happening right now, this year. That's what this year is all about, is the apocalypse. And that's when, what's it called, the truth comes to the surface. That's what I'm seeing, and that's what I'm trying to explain, or I guess is happening. We're done with the Armageddon. That ended maybe 2 or 3 years ago when we started the Iraq War, and how it progressed, and it just kept getting thwarted every time, and what's it called, and you know, there's always setbacks, and then the past 2 or 3 years, all the truths have been coming. I mean, if you read the news, I don't even know, it's so much, I'm not even going to go into it, but the truth is coming out every day as we get closer to, as you said, the approach date of 2012, which is actually I've been doing research on that lately too, about the planet Nibiru. Have you heard about that?
Oh, I have heard about planet Nibiru, and in fact, the third volume of The Ark of Millions of Years is now on my laptop in finished form. It's been edited, and it's ready to go to the publisher, so we expect it to come out at the end of February and be available. And it is the latest and the most comprehensive information on 2012 on Earth, period.
Well, I don't even think 2012 is coming. I think by the time most of us get to 2012, the concept of marking a little date on our calendar for 2012 won't really exist. And the only ones paying attention will probably be the astronomers and the astrologers that have more advanced time clocks than the Christian calendar, I think, that we go by right now.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And all this ties together with this technology that I'm talking about tonight. Because SETI understood this. SETI the First understood this in Jesus' day, and he was trying to build a device that would allow him to toggle between worlds so that he could bring advanced technology, advanced living conditions back to this world. And it is, well, it is evident that he succeeded somewhat, and he was able to travel between worlds, and there is real evidence that he was able to do that.
The stargates and
a stargate,
whatever you want to call them. Yeah, that's exactly what they were. And they used them a lot in ancient Egypt. Well, I don't know if it was Egypt, like you mentioned before. It's pre-Egypt, post-Atlantis, or whatever you want to call it. I mean, there's so much history, and I'm not really good with dates and names, but I know it happened. And what's it called? They use that technology in extensive technologies beyond just stargates. They had the hieroglyphs. Claim they had beam crafts and, you know, little disc crafts, and they had airplanes and gyro, whatever you want to call them, you know, like helicopters, I guess. And what's it called?
It's just evident. In Dendara, if you go to Dendara, you walk in the front door, walk forward about 20 feet on the right-hand side of the main hall going in, look up against
the
ceiling. I have. And look up against the ceiling, and there it sits, four different kinds of spacecraft and helicopters, plain as day. And I have numerous, I probably have 40 photographs of that thing. So,
About that photograph that you mentioned of the, what was it, the thing you saw in Tibet, I'm sorry, I'm really bad with names. The Tesla coil that was adorned in jewels and gold.
Tesla coil in Tibet. Yeah.
Yes.
Tupa. Right.
Yeah, I saw a picture of that. I watched one of your lectures on some streaming website. Someone must have had a camera in the audience. And one of the lectures you gave, the picture of it, and it's very beautiful, very ornate. You wouldn't even tell what it was, like if you were looking from the scientific point of view, until,
right,
like you said, you figured it out and put a thing over it. It looks like a religious idol altar.
You almost can't tell from a photograph. You walk around that thing and see how large it is and look at it from all sides, and you go, holy crap, that's a Tesla coil, my friends. Now, I know all the pilgrims that go in there think it's, you know, some method for, you know, praying and getting yourself to heaven, but it is absolutely clear that they were applying the best technology they knew to open a four-dimensional stargate. They had it painted on the ceiling right above it.
This is another thing that ties into what you were talking about earlier with Tesla and the thing that happened where he made Mark Twain shoot his pants, which is awesome because Tesla's one of my heroes. And what's it called? And all those Americana guys. I'd love to hear how they got embarrassed. I love that. That was a good story. But I lost my train of thought. What was it? About Tesla. A lot of the technologies which you're talking about with the Osiris machine or the Osiris device and everything, if you take the altar or whatever you call it, if you take those machines and you run electricity through them, they do, what's it called, they'll do exactly what we have today. The computer that I'm using right now runs on silicon chips, you know, and all that other garbage and stuff. But if you were to take that and you were to create it with, say, I don't know, stones and twigs even, you know, if you were, say, a shaman or a magician somewhere out in, you know, the jungles in Africa or maybe down in South America or Mexico, you know, and you were to take it, and I just watched a lecture on this today online about the guy, this one guy, he went to Africa, and he did a study on fractals and noticed how they would look at satellite images of African villages, and they noticed how when they built it, looked above, everything was made in fractals. As it was, they built this tiny little altar in the middle of the town that was microscopic, that had a little village, and then on the outside they'd build the king's village, and then outside of that would be the king's immediate village, and outside of that would be the regular village. It was a fractal, and what's it called? These devices work. I'd imagine if you walk through that village, you feel a very nice energy as you would looking at a fractal on the internet. The, you know what I'm talking about?
Well, it's clear that iconology, this ability to actually, or just simply look at something, does have great effects. I'll give you an example. Moses was leading his army against another army, another move of annihilation, and his army was having a hard time winning, and so he would just simply raise his staff in the air, and as long as the staff was in the air, they would win, and as soon as he lowered his arms, they began to lose again. So he had his helpers hold his arms in the air so the staff could be raised up. It was said that if they just looked upon the staff, they would then have the skill and added stamina to go forward. And in another episode, they were traveling, and some people were bitten by snakes, and they were dying, and Moses simply took his staff and said, you know, if you just look on the staff, you'll be healed. And it says in the scriptures, because of the simpleness of the way, many did perish. And they were looking for a complicated answer. You also look at the Middle Ages when the Crusaders were sent out all over to confiscate and destroy icons because it was idolatry and the church was dead set against it. If you talk to any Muslim today, or any Jew today, he will tell you idolatry is evil and you should not have any kind of idols whatsoever. But it is known in pagan lore, in Wiccan lore, that predates all these guys, that icons had a powerful ability to excite a DNA evolution inside a person, just looking upon it, because the original way to be communicated...
This is all, I'm going to go a little pseudoscience metaphysics here. The way that works is because of the geometry. We're in the physical reality. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with the concept of the matrix theory that we're existing reality, and we're actually souls operating from a remote source, or the whole idea is to come within to the physical body, you know what I'm saying? That whole concept, I'm sure everyone doesn't need a lecture on that. And the things that we create around us have geometry, and they give off frequency. Everything's frequency. We're made of water. That's why we can transmit frequency, the thing I was talking about with the brain earlier. I mean, we're made of water, and how well water transmits vibration, especially when you have trace elements of, you know, copper and iron and whatever else we're held, silicon, whatever else we're made out of, you know what I'm saying? And this is the same concept, is when you make things, or, you know, an idol, to say, is that idol takes the form of whatever vibration you assign it to it, or the geometry that it's created from. It has a physical vibration. That's what holds it together and gives it the form that it is. You know what I'm saying? And
let's do a little more rudimentary form, okay? We're communicating right now with words. Words are symbols that we use to put our pictures in a row so that we can have sentences and coherent thought. But the words, ultimately, are just pictures. A cat is a cat, not C-A-T. An elephant is an elephant, not E-L-P-H, you know, blah, blah, blah. And an icon is a symbol of knowledge that we once knew, and it communicates to us non-verbally. It communicates to us directly with a picture.
Exactly, because it gives off a vibration that our brains, our transmitters and receivers pick up on, and we understand it on a unconscious level, or I don't know how everyone explain it. A sixth sense level, psychic level. I'm not sure if everyone's third eye is open and they're familiar with that. But, sorry.
We have a lot of third eye people that listen to this program, so.
I'm sure we do.
Well, what you're saying is exactly right. And getting back to this whole idea that there is a cosmos of knowledge. Some people call it the Akashic Record. Some people call it the mass consciousness, the collective consciousness, that there is nothing new under the sun, or as above, so below. All information is out there.
What's it called? You just reminded me of one of my favorite quotes. I think Teddy Roosevelt said it when he created the CIA after they started the bombs, the Manhattan Project and everything. It's my favorite quote. There's nothing new in this world except the truth that you don't know, or the history that you don't know, which is one of my favorite quotes of all time.
Well, that's interesting, because history is always written by the victor.
Well, the physical history, the truth is always there. The history and truth are very different sometimes.
Oh, all the time. I doubt very seriously that history is truth.
That's one thing, is the truth is in everything. Even if you could tell the most grandiose lie, and from that lie you can derive the truth from it, because if you know that the person is lying, you know that the opposite of whatever they're saying must be the truth.
Not necessarily. I mean, according to Tesla, or not? I mean, Max Planck, he said the opposite of a truth might be another truth.
Well, that can also hold true also. And that also goes into, if you want to go into psychology or whatever the saying is, that the truth is everyone has their own personal truth. You know, my truth is not your truth. What is true to me doesn't hold true to you. And every other person on this planet that has an ego, self-conscious, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. So what do we do as creators?
I was about to go into the history of that before, but I decided not to.
Since we're given power and authority over our own truth, and now we have full responsibility over our own life condition, what do we do as creators with that knowledge?
Well, we can create positive growth. We can create, like you said earlier, we can create positive experiences, growth, knowledge, love, whatever you want to call it, or you can destroy and hate and fear and harm others, and it's all about free will and light and dark, whatever you want to call it, the duality, finding peace in those dualities.
Well, those are fine statements to make for people who are conscious, but what about the people who are not conscious that they're conscious?
Are you talking about the sleepers, anyone who's still sleeping through this storm?
That's correct. They're sleeping, but they are still affecting the universe. They're still like bulls in a china shop. They're still slamming around in the very delicate social structure of society. They're asleep, and they're having profound effects. I just watched a whole bunch of it for 15 minutes. That's all I could stand. Then I had to go take a pill of the primaries. Watching the primaries on television, I couldn't do it. It was
the elective government. That's always good for. It's really sad how people buy into that play and everything, and what's it called? The whole it's just another entertainment program. I mean, you're better off watching a cartoon or maybe a television program, you know, prime time, than watching the election. I mean, it's both a fabricated story. It's just that one's a satire and one's believed to be reality, or whoever believes that is their reality. Your reality is what you created it.
You have more entertainment and probably more life value out of watching today's Super Bowl than you would watching the elections.
No, I'd say you'd probably get more life value watching something about a sci-fi, or maybe a movie sci-fi drama, or maybe I don't know, something with, I don't know, you know what I'm saying, a fantasy than watching the elections on if Barack Obama's going to win over Hillary, because either way our country is going into a shitter, in my opinion, and I'm counting on it so there can be a revolution and we can save everybody, but just a hopeful youth.
Hopefully it will be like Nick Begich talks about, a bloodless revolution. Anyone who goes to Washington for any of time, and I'm talking Washington, D.C., we'll notice in a heartbeat that government is not elected. Government is the bureaucrats. Blocks and blocks and floors of bureaucracy in that city. Those are the people that survive election to election to election. They're not elected. They're not in the news.
And well, they are elected. They're elected by their peers. And they're elected by people who like them and agree with their ideas. And you don't say that they're not elected because they are. That's the loophole that they use. Just be aware of that. That's one of my favorite things to do is you have to make sure you know how they're doing it. So when you think of what they're doing, you can laugh at it and transmute that negative energy instead of saying, because like I said, whatever your truth is, the truth is that they are being elected. They're being elected by their peers. Now, don't say that they're being elected by you and me and the free citizens of the world, you know, because that's not true. They're being elected by a select group of people, and we should acknowledge that and try to change it without going through the system, because we realize the system is on the system.
I don't believe that a partnership in crime is an election. I don't believe that a perpetuated conflict of interest, one person scratching another person's back so that they can keep their job and their pensions and all that and still control their budgets, I don't think that's an election. I think the attitude that, hey, we have to spend all of our money or they're going to take some away from us next year is wrong.
Oh, well, let's get off of politics. What was I going to say? I had a thought that popped into my head when we were saying something before the election thing. What were we talking about? It was about, I don't know, I forgot. Let's keep talking. It'll come back.
We need to talk about Abu Ghraib.
All right, let's go back to the
site. Abu Ghraib is a very remote site in Egypt. It is tucked away behind a little village. You have to walk actually through a grove of trees, fig trees, to get past the barbed wire, to get out to the sand, to get to Abu Ghraib. It's not on the tourist trail, and it really takes official finagling and a security officer to get you out there.
It sounds hidden. It sounds like there's a lot of magic, and those trees themselves are probably portals. They probably planted those when they built the site. If you think about it, they probably laid them out so they were well hidden, and that people that weren't conscious enough to go there didn't see those. All they saw were trees, and they didn't see what was behind the trees, and they just kept going. But anyone that would be aware or awake to that energy that would be laying behind that tree would see whatever they wanted to see. That's all perception. But anyway, go on.
Rob is sort of the outskirts of Memphis. Memphis is only 30%, if that, excavated. 70% of it still lies underneath the sands of Egypt. But the interesting thing is that Abu Ghraib has the most highly machined large blocks of alabaster in the most curious design I have ever witnessed. It's unbelievable. We're talking 20-ton blocks of alabaster machined as smooth as a piece of glass, fitted together so tightly you can't fit a piece of paper between them.
Yep.
And in the center of these square blocks is a column, it's about a meter and a half in diameter, and who knows how deep it goes into the ground, of machined round alabaster, like it was put on a huge lathe, turned round, and then driven into the ground. Around it are 16 alabaster bowls, and these bowls have a beveled edge at the top, like some kind of machine fit against it. And outside the beveled edge is a sprocket machined out of alabaster, 25 teeth on a pitch, precisely all the way around this thing, as though this bowl fit onto a machine.
And one question, how old is all this stuff? What's the date on it, or what's the supposed date?
9500 B.C.
9500 B.C., so that's like around the beginning of what we consider modern human history, right?
No, about 3,500 years prior to that.
Well, I mean civilized history. I'm not talking monkeys and apes evolving.
Well, I mean, it changes the history books, because the history books start at about 4,000 B.C., start at 9,500
BC. Well, I could go into hours. I could use your whole next 2 hours talking about past civilizations and all that information, but save that for another show, I guess. But, no, the technologies were, the lost civilizations and all that stuff, as, technologies were left over between the Great Flood. I wanted to talk about that, too, with the Nibiru coming up and the storms coming, the apocalypse, not the apocalypse, the Armageddon. No, yeah, it was the apocalypse, not the Armageddon. That is coming, that's coming this year. I mean, people should be prepared for it. When you run that ad about the water guys, they sell the water and the prepackaged food, everyone that's listening should be paying attention to those and buying at least a basic kit off. Because if you're not living...
A lot of people go to NitroPack. I mean, they got the best 72-hour kits I've ever seen, and they have, you know, all the food that you need for a whole person for an entire year, all packed up and ready to go.
Well, what's it called? I'll run an ad for them. Is that from a profit standpoint of view, other than the worry wart, you know, reality people, that's a good investment. Because, what's it called? If you follow the astrology, what's supposed to be happening.
It's being a Boy Scout. I mean, things happen. You know, there are hurricanes, earthquakes, storms, power outages. I mean,
and that's what they
have war, some big kind of accident happen, or some kind of cosmic apocalypse, but being without food for 3 days, hey, we're not used to that.
No, most people aren't. But, no, it's coming, man. So that's one thing I was going to say is, what did I read? That the storm's only supposed to get worse because Nibiru's coming closer and we're actually on the wrong side of the planet or something like that. I'm not sure the details right now.
Now, is Nibiru on the other side of the sun from the Earth, and that's why we can't detect it?
Well, actually, no, we can detect it. I actually saw pictures online where down in the South Pole, the guy's sitting on Antarctica, and the research stations, you know, they have the big microscopes, telescopes out there. And I saw a good picture that it was, I don't even think it was that amplified. The guy took it, he was sitting down there, he took a picture, and you see the picture of the sun coming up, and you see a little red sun next to it. That's Nibiru, because it's so big in our sky. And supposedly by the year 2009, I think 2009, and then around 2010, it's supposed to be in the sky as a double sun. It'll look like a double sun, that you'll be able to see it during the day and at night as a big red object in our sky. And the guys down at Antarctica, you know, in South America, the tips of South America can see it already. And by next year, most of the Southern Hemisphere is supposed to be able to see it, if I'm not mistaken, from what I read earlier this week.
Well, I guess John Gress better come out with his movie this year, or it's going to be too late.
Everyone's going to be like, well, no, it might not be too late. You know, a lot of people are going to be like, what the hell is happening? Only an explanation.
Well, John Gress is producing a movie called One Anunnaki. And he is a Sitchinite through and through, and he has taken the works of Zachariah Sitchin and turned it into one of three feature films. The first one's called One Anunnaki, and of course the second will be Two, and so forth. The first one is designed to make people aware that the Anunnaki were here and that they are now returning, and they don't have our best interests in mind. The
Some of them have changed sides and do work within our interests and the other forces that be.
Well, that's one of the reasons Abu Ghraib was so important to us, because it showed up as Anunnaki technology. It was clear that this site was used to process gold. It was used to sluice and concentrate gold.
That's why they came here in the first place. They went down to Africa, South Africa. It's supposedly, if you go down to South Africa, the creation stories, or the, you know, the tribesmen and the shamans, they say that the men came from the sky, and they said, and they gave them a choice and said, we'll give you this if you dig the gold for us. And that's why there's still that karma. The karma's still there. They still got the guys and the slaves in the gold mine, and you know, the white man's still making the money off of them, which I'm assuming is the white man, whoever the hell that is the incarnation, or the ones who decided to hold that karma for the Anunnaki who left and came back and all that other stuff, you know what I'm saying? But it still goes on today, yeah, man. The gold is a very valuable resource. There's a lot of gems that come off of Earth that if you took onto another planet, it would probably make you put you in a very high place of power. I mean, we don't realize how powerful our planet is, and this matrix reality that we live in, and the actual power of the being able to hold something and being able to touch your mother or your child or anything. It's a very powerful thing, and a lot of people don't realize it, and they take it for granted, and a lot of other things, and I don't know what to say.
Well, it's interesting. We think that civilizations out there must be advanced enough that they could just, through alchemical processes, make their own gold. But we physicists know that all protons are not created equal. And
once you get down to iron
is the lowest order protons in the periodic chart. Hydrogen is the highest. And it takes a long way out on the periodic chart, just to about 94 atomic number, which is gold, to get back up to those highly energetic protons. So it's not just simply a matter of turning lead into gold.
Well, yeah. If I'm not mistaken, didn't the Earth do that, taking a few million years during development? And that's why we find it in the rocks and ore, right?
Well, actually, no. Those higher order elements are created during supernova events. And then they decay. Everything decays down to iron. So ore and minerals and everything were probably created in the very first few moments that Earth became coagulated as a planet. The fact that they're stratified and located in concentrated areas close to the surface where we can mine them in different places has to do with affinities with different crystals and different deposits, different forces. Areas that were affected by large amounts of water and areas that were affected by large amounts of overthrust, that is to say hard rocks that were pushed up through the crust as mountains brought the ore to the surface where we could reach it easily.
So that means that they're digging even deeper than what we can see, and there must be a lot more under the surface.
Oh, yeah.
But that goes in your hollow earth theory there.
We've only scratched the surface of our planet. I mean, we've only, at best, drilled 6 miles into the crust, at best. The Earth is 7,600 miles thick, and the crust being somewhere around, I don't know, 800 or 900 miles thick, we haven't even begun to discover our planet.
No, that's what the expedition is about. Is that update going to come in the third hour, I'd assume?
Yeah, actually, I can do it now. I've got about 15 minutes in this hour. We have, of course, taken great strides with the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. We've got more video footage that's getting ready to be converted into a DVD, along with some fantastic original slides, and we're going to issue the Inner Earth Expedition Part 2, so there will be Part 1 and Part 2, and then Part 3 will be later on this year. That's the target. We have a very good producer on board, Emerald Films, out of Hollywood, and we are having some very high-level meetings right now for large amounts of funding to get the voyage paid for. The good news is that we have been steadily assembling a marvelous team of experts, from under-ice divers to extreme condition videographers, scientists, experts in Arctic tectonic plate technology, water analysis, seafloor coring. We've got some fantastic people that have joined our 100-man team. We've got engineers working on the color and sound experiment that we're going to be doing in the pool on the ship. We're going to be creating a consciousness beacon as part of the experiment. I can't throw it out. I can't just say, well, it's consciousness. It doesn't have anything to do with science. Nonsense. We're going to design an experiment to try to apply the consciousness aspect to the discovery of what might be a multidimensional opening to the inner Earth.
Now, when build a model of the machines, we're talking about the Anunnaki technology, the, what's it called, that we were talking about earlier, that you found in Egypt, and build a scale model of that.
Actually, that was discussed. This last week, we discussed building a full-size OSIRIS device, but we're not going to build it in Egypt. We're going to build it in Nashville.
Nashville.
That's correct. Well, that's where the mall is. If you go to the Parthenon and you go to the OSIRIS shaft that is located in Nashville, this is incredible ancient technology that has been renovated and has been built and designed in Nashville. The logical location to build the OSIRIS device is Nashville.
Right down in the south, right?
That's in Tennessee.
It's a continent.
And, those of you that listen to this program, if you live close to or have the opportunity to get to Boston, make sure that you do not pass up the Boston Museum of Science. You definitely
Hello?
Want to see that. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still there. Sorry, I had a glitch in the thing. I couldn't hear you for a second.
I said you definitely want to make sure that you get to the Boston Museum of Science. It's to be the best $10 you've spent.
Down in Nashville. Is it down in Nashville or something?
That's in Boston. It has the world's largest Van de Graaff generator in it, and if you want to see Tesla technology demonstrated in front of your eyes, and I'm talking 12-foot lightning bolts, go Sorry, I think your phone's breaking up or something. I'm getting about every third word that you're saying.
Okay. Well, I can hear you.
Okay. Anyway, that's
okay.
The gist of the OSIRIS device. Building a structure like that and then charging admission for people to come in to look at it will be a steady stream for new research and new technology and new discovery. And it'll be a fantastic display of ancient technology.
I don't know, I'm at a loss for words, Doctor. It's just too much to put into words for you. My mind's going a mile a minute, and you know how my fingers usually go on the keyboard during the show.
I've never seen anybody enter as many times as you do, and it's like a steady flow of input in the instant messenger. Of course, don't discount out the live stream generator that's put out by Zero Point Research. This is sort of a personal version of the OSIRIS device. It provides a very mild, manageable magnetic field that has fantastic rejuvenative effects on the human body. I just cannot describe it to you. You have to experience it yourself.
I think I saw those. Those are on like the BBS page. They're like little pendants or like circles, and they put a gem in the middle and they have little pyramids on them. Is that what you're talking about?
Nope, that's not it at all. The light stream generator is a magnetic field generator. It is a very unique frequency. I've seen the technology myself. I've demonstrated it, and I have even helped manufacture it on a production basis. And I can tell you that it's extremely reliable, very repeatable, and I've seen it more than 100 times have profound health results on people.
So what's it look like? How does it set up?
Well, right now, it sort of looks like a room ionizer, I guess you could call it. Comes in a hermetically sealed containment, just like you would buy an electrical appliance. It plugs into the wall, uses DC power, 12 volts DC. And the technology on the inside is proprietary, but I can tell you that it's real. All you have to do is put your hand on it, and you can feel it. What?
It's like a black box. There's tons of technology where people put things together and you plug them into the wall with direct current and they put off all different kinds of frequencies. I've read tons of stuff like that on the net. It's all over the place.
This is DC. This does not put off any AC. I can tell you definitively, any technology you find out there that puts out alternating current, avoid it like the plague.
No. I agree with you. Tesla's my hero. Like I said, he fought alternating current for years, and we still use it like idiots today. But what's it called? No, I said direct current. I did say direct current. You find that stuff from, they call them shock boxes. There's tons of technology on the internet like that. So is it something like that, like a black box with a bunch of different things lined up inside, and you plug it in, it puts off a frequency?
It doesn't put off a frequency. It's just a DC magnetic field, and the field rotates, but there's no frequency to it.
I see.
I can tell you that there's no technology out there like it, because there are two core components, and they are only manufactured by Zero Point Research. They are not manufactured anywhere else. Accept no imitations. I've seen them all, and I've rejected them all, except for this one. This one's real.
So is that going commercial use, or they're trying to get their idea out without getting snuffed by the medicine guys?
Nope, they're not making any medical claims at all. This is just an energy experience. That's how they're getting around it. And we have had one production trial. We're getting ready to have another one. And the first one was so successful that we're going to try a second production run. And the idea is to go into mass production with this and get the price down to where the average person can afford it. Right now, I think the 100s run around $3,900. And that's just a little bit out of reach for most people. But a 100 can benefit a whole lot of people. Lots and lots of people can use the same unit. But obviously, if they get the price down, they can get the technology out to more people, then it'll have even more profound effect. And there is so much peer review on this technology, it's unbelievable. In fact, there is a device that has just been talked about. Let me go down here and just look at this. An experimental helmet has been released in Europe, in Britain, for clinical use, which scientists say could reverse symptoms of Alzheimer's disease within weeks of being used, is to be tried out on patients. The strange-looking headgear, which has to be worn for 10 minutes every day, bathes the brain with infrared light and stimulates the growth of brain cells. Its creators believe it could reverse the symptoms of dementia, such as memory loss and anxiety, after only 4 weeks. Alzheimer's disease charities last night described the treatment as potentially life-changing, but stressed that the research was still at the very early stages. Low-level infrared light is thought to stimulate the growth of cells of all types of tissue and encourage their repair. It is able to penetrate the skin and even get through the skull. He says, "We age because our cells lose the desire to regenerate and repair themselves. This ultimately results in cell death and decline of the organ functions for the brain, resulting in memory decay and deterioration in general intellectual performance." So what is a good source of that wavelength of infrared light? How about molten iron, the same wavelength as the core of the earth? So maybe the legends of extremely long life in the inner earth are not so bizarre.
Hi, Scott Bagman?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Hey, I gotta go off the air because there's other people waiting behind me. I just want to say it was great talking to you tonight. If you have any time after the show, I'd really appreciate if you logged on to the AIM Instant Messenger. There's some other stuff I'd like to talk to you about personally.
I may do that as I prepare the show for upload. So,
So have a good night, and I'll be listening.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good night.
Talk to you later. All right. If we have another caller on the line, your first name and where you're calling from, please. All right. We are about 4 minutes before the end of the second hour of X Squared Radio. That was one of our...
You do have a caller.
I do have a caller, okay. What is the caller's first name, and where are you calling from, please?
Jonathan Sanders, can you hear me?
Yes, Jonathan, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Oh, not too much, man. I've been listening to your show. I'm out of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I actually spoke with you briefly today by email.
Ah, that's right, that's right. Good to hear from you, Jonathan.
I was studying a little bit about the Inner Earth theories here the last couple weeks. It's just totally captivated my interest. And just like anything that captivates my interest here lately, I dig into it full force until I completely understand everything about it. But, yeah, it's been completely interesting just kind of learning what's been found and kind of hearing some of the scientific data that's been backed up by it. And it looks like you've done a lot of research on it yourself and made some really good findings. And as I found out that there was actually an expedition going on to go check out the Northern Pole that you were leading, I just totally was interested in that. It's wanted to kind of call in and see if we could learn a little bit more about what you guys are doing up there.
Well, we'll absolutely do that. In about 3 minutes, I'm going to play a few commercials, and then we'll come right back and we'll talk about it, so I don't want you to go anywhere.
Sure.
I do want to say one thing, that a lot of this is not my research. Some of it is, but
sure.
A lot of it has been done independently by a lot of scientists who have done a lot of work. And
oh, yeah.
What my job as expedition leader is not to have the ego that, you know, claims all the credit, but to sort
right.
of unite the clans. We're trying to unite all of the little splinter groups and small research groups and small nonprofits that together we can be a very mighty force, and many hands make light work, and put together an expedition to actually go there and see if we can observe the conditions that might support an opening, whether it's our dimension or another dimension. Certainly the effects of the two should be detectable.
Sure.
So if he'll hang around, let me do just a little bit of bill paying. Don't go anywhere. Just listen on your phone. We'll play these commercials, and then we'll be right back. This helps
sure.
us pay the bills
okay.
here at X Squared Radio, and we're glad that you're here. So don't go away, and we will be back right after these messages. It's important that you hang around, and it's important you listen to all 3 hours. If you're not getting all 3 hours, let us know. We'll get you with your radio station and fix that right away. We'll be back right after these messages with more X Squared Radio. Our friends down at NRG Resources have introduced the new engine oil technology. TBT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TBT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TBT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the 6-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. And they have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have cracked.
Well, we want to welcome you back to X Squared Radio. We're trying to keep all this together so we can keep you going. And we thank you for coming on board. Sorry for the little intro music glitch. Don't know what's going on there. My MP3 player must be having a fit. Well, I've done a lot of flying lately, so I decided to dig out one of my poems I wrote a while back. It's called Night Flight. Night flight, blazing through ethered space at 10 miles a minute, or galaxies of ordered stars with corpuscles of red and white, glowing along gray veins, travelers with sundry soft halos, lonely and peaceful, spaced evenly in velvet hills, the reflected shimmer of moonlight dancing like white fire across thousands of liquid mirrors hidden in the darkness below. Oh, the condescension of dissension as airspeed yields to gravity and heaven becomes quiet and a tilted wing points toward God, with frozen moonlight gripping silver skin like a dancer's gentle hand mid-leap. And once again, wheels make for the green and rolling canvas from which we pray. Just a little observation out the window of the airplane coming in. We have a caller on the line, Jonathan from Oklahoma, Tulsa, Oklahoma. He had contacted me by email earlier, and we had discussed the Inner Earth expedition, and he is a technology supplier. And so he has called in, and we're going to discuss the Inner Earth expedition here this hour. And so welcome back, Jonathan.
Thank you. Yeah, I was, I was just kind of really interested and fascinated in what you guys were doing and kind of what your plans were when you got out there and kind of if you've got any, kind of an event calendar set up for what you're doing as you go out. You know, how long do you guys plan on being out in the North Pole region?
We're planning on 13 days at sea. We actually have a two-day contingency, so it could be between 13 and 15 days at sea. Everyone that is a member of the team will be flown from their point of origin, in your case it would be Tulsa, Oklahoma, to Moscow, and then from Moscow to Murmansk. Murmansk is on the very northern coast above St. Petersburg. In fact, if you look at a globe, you will see that Murmansk is actually above Finland, so it's way up there, up north. Now we will board the Yamal, which is a 450-foot-long, 23,000-ton nuclear-powered icebreaker. It is the only ship of its kind on Earth and the only one capable of making this expedition. There is no civilian craft that can do it other than this one.
And why is that?
Well, the other craft are diesel-powered, and they can only make 7 to 8 knots in the water, and even less than that through ice. They're too small, they can't handle the rough seas, and they don't have enough fuel to get all the way. This is about an 800-mile trek, half of it through ice, to get to the other side of the Arctic Circle. There are just no craft out of Alaska or Canada that can make this trip. We've spoken to the ship captains, and they admit they can't make it.
That's incredible. So how many times has this been attempted before, and has anyone successfully actually traveled this this route that you're taking?
Actually, it was impossible before because there was too much ice. We're talking 30 to 40 meters of ice. No icebreaker can go through that amount of ice. It's got to get down to about 2 meters for an icebreaker to be successful through it. Thanks to global warming, last year, the Northwest Passage opened for the first time in what's estimated to be 200,000 years. So this has never been attempted before.
That's incredible. So basically, we're just at the point where we've got the perfect timing of our weather and, whatever it considers a catastrophe of the heat and the ice melting that may just allow you guys to get this large ship through the destination that you're trying to get to in the Northern Pole.
That's correct. In fact, my recent investigations or communications up in that area have said that the Northwest Passage is beginning to refreeze. So we have this year, possibly next year, and then it's going to close up. It'll be closed off, in my mind, forever. We won't see it again for at least 100 years. So this is the opportunity we have to see the seafloor of our planet in a place that's never been seen before by human eyes. Now, I'm not saying dog sleds haven't been over the top of the ice, and I'm not saying military submarines haven't been under the ice, but nobody has actually looked down through the water at the seafloor at this area. And we're going to be dropping cables to the bottom of the ocean, taking core samples off the bottom of the sea, water samples. We'll be checking pH, crystallinity, salinity, density, magnetism. We're going to be doing experiments with the aurora borealis, taking sea life samples, both microscopic and fish, as well as trying to find the origin or the winter nesting place of the Ross gull, a gull discovered by my great-grandfather, Sir James Ross, and who also discovered the North Magnetic Pole, by the way.
Wow.
So we're back.
That's incredible. That is quite an incredible voyage. Something that sounds like it's going to be pretty important, that timing is definitely going to be of the essence to get this done quickly.
Well, about 2 years ago, when we were putting this together, someone said, "Why, this is the greatest expedition in the history of the world," and the name stuck.
Well, that is incredible. What do you expect the temperatures to be whenever you get out there?
The what to be?
What do you expect the temperatures to be whenever you get out there? What is that area of the planet like during the summer?
Our recent check last summer, the temperatures got up to 32 degrees.
Oh,
wow. We expect the temperatures to be somewhere around 20, maybe a little above that. The issue is not necessarily the temperature, it's the wind, and it's the exposure, because you're out where there are no trees, there are no mountains. The ship makes about 22 knots in open water. It makes about 8 knots in the ice. You turn your ship into a 50-mile-an-hour wind at 20 knots, and you have a 70-mile-an-hour wind at 20 degrees coming over the bow. You may have 120-foot seas. So, obviously, we have about 700 applicants. We have 100 spaces. We've so far found 64 suitable passengers. And these people have various scientific skills, video skills, diving skills, and analytical skills as far as marine biology and things like that.
Right.
We also have two doctors, and we have various metaphysical contributors as well, not just in exopolitics, but also in observation of UFOs, observation and training in human consciousness. We're trying to control, monitor, and record aspects of this experiment which have made themselves known over the last 2 years. Now, I know some scientific expeditions would just throw out the stuff they're not interested in. But, you know, we get one shot at this. So we're going to try to gather all the information we can, and we expect to shoot at least 3,000 hours of video during these 13 days.
Oh. Yeah, that is pretty incredible. What kind of things do you guys see are going to be, you know, possible hurdles that you have to cross over this? Is there going to be any possibilities that you may just run into ice that you can't cross, or anything that you may see as a danger to the expedition that could keep you from making this an accomplishment?
Yes, to all of the above. Now, the Yamal is an incredible vehicle. If the snow that we've had this year, which has really increased the albedo of North America, and it snowed in places like Baghdad, for crying out loud, this year. So we've reflected a lot of energy back out into space. It's possible we will not have that warm of a summer, and it's quite possible that we may be entering the next ice age, or at least a mini ice age, in the sense that Canada isn't going to thaw out the way it normally does. If that's the case, the Northwest Passage may build up ice several meters that just doesn't melt next summer. So, yes, there is a possibility that we won't get there. But we believe that even if the ice gets up to 9 meters, we can still make it with the Yamal. So we've got a window of opportunity, and it's closing fast. But we're going to try and make it with this ship. That's the one obstacle. The other is, you know, of course, funding is always a challenge. It's probably 95% of any expedition is trying to find sources of funding that can see the same vision that we do. It would be nice to just have people come up and say, well, here's the money that you need for the charter of the ship, and, you know, go to it and try to get as much great information as you can, and we'll put out a great documentary, and hopefully people will watch it. We put out a pilot documentary last November, and we won the Genes of Galileo contest in Japan. The Japanese are absolutely crazy over this expedition. 17 million Japanese watched that pilot, and over 16,000 of them called in to Nippon Television Network and told them that they wanted our hypothesis to win the contest. We beat out 11 other documentaries for that award.
That's incredible. So how close are you to fulfilling the finances you need for this voyage?
Well, we're still a long ways off. I'd say, we still probably lack about $1.5 million. But, that kind of money is, in some senses, it's a huge amount of money. In other senses, it's not much money at all. What it takes is contacts with the right sources. Now, we could have every listener to this program send in a dollar, we'd be there. But people don't do that. So we envision 10, maybe 20 key investors who see 18 DVDs coming on the back end, that there's a slim possibility they could make their money back and maybe even a profit. And hopefully from that vision, that business plan, they will be able to see that this kind of expedition needs to be taken.
Well, I definitely agree. I mean, even at the smallest possibility that you find something new out there, something that we have never seen before, some small piece of our Earth that is unexplained or is completely new to us is completely worth going out investigating. I agree.
Well, that's what I say. And I'm not saying, we're not trying to sensationalize this and say, oh, we're going to film UFOs or we're going to find an opening into the inner Earth.
Sure.
But you know, it's clear that we are having these anomalies. We are seeing them from space. We're seeing them with our USGS data. We're seeing them with our marine biology observations. So why not go to the source? Let's just see if there's some kind of sea vent or if this oceanic depression really exists. And even if they don't, we're still going to be able to investigate an area of the planet that's never been seen before.
That's right.
It's a lot more feasible than flying
right
to Mars.
Yeah, I agree. That's worth it right there alone. Absolutely. So, what are some of the anomalies that you've noticed before? I know that you discussed a couple of them in previous talk shows that I've listened to in previous archives. I think one of them that you mentioned was a type of seagull that was found in that area and only in that area that you found continually each year flew to the north instead of the south as it got colder. Is that right?
Yeah. The seagull, the Ross gull, is just a small bird. It's even small by California seagull standards. And it doesn't have a bunch of blubber on its body like a penguin. And it just isn't built for Arctic winters. And yet, it flies north in the winter. And it nests in the south. So, it nests in the areas around Norway and Sweden, and then it flies north for the winter. Now, it's never been tracked. I spoke to the world's leading ornithologist on this bird, and he doesn't know where the nesting area of this bird is. No one's been able to put a tracking device on the bird and let it fly to the north with that and then go to the north to find it. There are no GPS satellites that look at the North Pole. So it's going to have to be a very clever experiment to see if we can find out where these birds nest. If we do, that's a Nobel Prize in zoology right there.
Absolutely, and that will completely change. If there is anything found, that will completely change most of the history and most of the scientific, most of the ground that we build all the knowledge of our Earth on. And that's not such a crazy thought, because it wasn't that long ago that most everybody here thought that we had a flat planet, that our Earth wasn't round. And that completely changed everybody's point of view. And if you were to approach anybody at that time and say, you know, our Earth is round, it's not flat, what you've learned all of your life is wrong, they would have treated you with the same kind of skepticism. So I don't think it's a crazy idea at all.
Well, you know what's interesting? Just watching Fox News, most recently the O'Reilly factor. Fox News, the last, I'm going to say 9 months, on a regular basis, has been running stories on UFOs without a naysayer at the end of the program. They were talking about this craft that was recently spotted down in Texas, in Stephenville, Texas, on the O'Reilly factor, and they didn't have anybody come on afterwards and say, ah, this is a lot of hooey, it was probably an airplane or a weather satellite or, you know, swamp gas. What they're doing, in my opinion, the program directors are beginning to soften up the public, because it's inevitable for us to find out that we are not alone in the universe, let alone on this Earth.
Sure.
Now, logic, we just keep slicing away with Occam's razor. Logic would say that if 14% of the United States, as recently polled, say that they have seen a UFO, I did the math. That's 49 million people in this country say they have seen a UFO. That's a lot of folks. And there's more than that that believe in them. These are just the people that have seen them.
Sure.
If you were going to visit this planet and you didn't want your camping site trampled all over by curiosity seekers, where would you park? I'd park above the Arctic Circle. And that's why we're bringing Jose Escamilla and his UFO filming team with us. If the presence of this ship and the presence of this consciousness signature that we will intend in place is enough to bring a UFO to us and we get it on film, that changes everything as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I'm sure there will be a lot of people that take notice, and I'm sure there will still be those that that pull that skepticism out and try to rip it apart. But nonetheless, that would be an amazing find. Absolutely.
Well, that's why we have this very unique idea, and that's why we contacted Jonathan back, because one of the things we want to do is we want to stream live from the ship 24 hours a day. We're going to have four cameras tied into a server. We'll have a director that switches back and forth between the four cameras, so that you can find out what's going on with the people, what's going on with the experiments, and what's going on over the bow of that ship.
Absolutely. And that technology exists. It's something,
and if something
be hard,
pops up,
especially for the people that are donating to this.
Yeah, exactly. And hopefully we can get an equipment company like maybe HP or Dell or Gateway or somebody to donate the equipment to it. I mean, we're not going to break it. We're not going to use it up. Just loan it to us for the 13 days. We'll give you all the credits in the world on the film. And let us stream this information live from the deck. And then there's no question, because people can log on and watch what's going on and run it on their computers, TiVo it if you want to. We want you
sure.
to see what we see. And that way, if a military ship pulls in front of the Yamal and says, hey, you cannot go into these international waters because we don't want you to find out what's out there, guess what? They're on national television.
Sure. Now, does there exist to this date? This is where my knowledge doesn't reach, is in the regions of that area, and the ability to communicate via satellite and actually, you know, obtain some type of data feed that you can use. Is there any type of satellite or anything that you can actually connect to receive data and send data that you would be able to broadcast this with?
That's a really good question. I believe there is, because there's ship-to-shore phones out there, and they use a satellite uplink.
Then I'm sure there would be as well.
You can access two satellites, but you can't access three. You need three satellites to get the Z data, your altitude. Now, planes can do it, but they fly at 8 miles high.
boats can't do it because they're down on the surface. They only get two satellites, which will give you X and Y, that is to say longitude and latitude information, but nothing more. When you drive around on the freeways down here in flyover country, you can access up to 12 GPS satellites. That's why you can locate yourself down to the nearest meter. But up there, you only get three.
Now, and correct me if I'm not wrong, but I do believe I read somewhere that the only two or three satellites that are actually in orbit that travel our planet at the vertical axis are not available. The data that they capture is not available to the public. Is that correct?
As of February 6, 2007, the Data Denial Act was enacted by Congress, denying access to satellites for ground-based data. That is to say, you can get weather data up to the 30th parallel. Beyond that, it's blocked. So they actually only restricted
just that area.
That's correct. Those of you that think you're going to Google Earth and looking at above the 30th parallel, you're not. If you're thinking that you're above the 60th parallel, I'm sorry, 70th parallel, between 70 and 90, and you think you're getting real-time pictures, you're not. It's all animated.
So they've actually had to create that data and simulated some kind of data that could be filled into those gaps?
That's correct. In fact, just recently, there's been a 29-mile-long orange cylinder that's been reportedly found in the center of Greenland. But the latitude and longitude, we're at 70 degrees north, 40 degrees west. I'm sorry, minus 40 degrees west. And if you look on Google Earth, you may still be able to find this object. Sorry, it's animated. It doesn't exist.
Sure. Yeah, that sounds pretty interesting. You know, there's very few reasons I can imagine why they'd want to have that area restricted as far as the data that we can access and view.
Well, I'm not a very good why person. I, you know, when it comes to speculating as to why they issued the Data Denial Act, if you just look at the last sentence of the act, it says that they can deny access during times of crisis or war. And I get the feeling that just about anything could be a crisis. Geez Louise, have you turned on the news lately? You get crisis in alphabetical order, for crying out loud. I don't know what that means, but it seems to me that imaging data is being denied to low-level targeting systems. So if somebody wanted to put a cruise missile together and feed it video data so that it could fly over the North Pole or over the Arctic Circle and come into the U.S. or Europe via northern regions at low altitude, they might want to use that data. But it's a wash, because you can't get surface data from space like that. It's always with clouds. So that's why, you know, there are no publicly available images of the North Pole. They just don't exist. Now, we got X-ray ones. We got ultraviolet ones. We got infrared ones. But there's no real-time visible data.
Yeah, that definitely sounds like there's something there that's amiss. There's something up there that must be important enough to be hidden by the powers that be.
Yeah, well, I don't know what the powers that be are. I mean, I've been there. I've driven around the place. It's filled with bureaucrats, and people think that, you know, oh, they're not going to let the Inter-Earth Expedition take place. You know what? They don't even know we exist. And even if they did know we existed, they don't care. They hope we come back with all kinds of film. Because all they have to say is, hey, it's just swamp gas. It's all special effects. It doesn't exist. Who's going to be able to prove us wrong? Who's going to prove us right?
They've been able to prove many different things wrong. Back it up with scientific data.
No one will ever be able to verify it, because who's going to raise $2 million to rent the Yamal and go do it again? It's taken us 2 years to get this far. It's
true.
Very, very tough to do. And that,
I'll tell you what. Have you had anybody actually working on the idea of what needs to take place with the communications on the ship, to actually send signal and receive and send data from the ship during your expedition. Have you guys actually gone to that point yet?
We've gotten almost to that point. Normally when we set up satellite operations for sequencing operations for the automotive industry, these are sequencing operations are where we stack supplies to the automotive assembly plant. They don't actually build parts at the assembly plant. They just build cars. And the cars come down the line of different colors. There'll be red ones and black ones and whatever, 60 different colors of automobiles. Well, things like rearview mirrors and carpet and seat trim and appliques and all that have to be color coordinated. They're sent to the assembly line in the order that they come out of the paint house. Well, the paint house sends a broadcast to the sequencing operation about 2 hours before those parts are needed. They're shipped every 28 minutes to the plant in order. Those transmissions are all done by ground-based dishes that point one plant to the other. And that's how we do these high-speed communications. And we send the broadcast wirelessly to printers throughout the plant. It used to be done with vacuum tubes and little carriers like you send your check to the bank and the drive-up teller. But that technology is way outdated, and they need to be able to move packouts around the plant at will, so they just set up wireless printers. All this technology exists, but we've never run a trial up there. And it would be interesting to run a trial up there to make sure we don't have some kind of electromagnetic interference.
You know, and that's something that that I will probably start to dig into for you and report to you on what the findings are and what the possibilities are. I'm sure that there hasn't been many attempts made to have any kind of a data communication while they're up there. Maybe there has. You know, I'm not sure. It's not a common thing to try and set up a nautical, you know, communication system in you know, the northern pole region, but it's
yeah.
I would be definitely interested in finding out.
Well, those of you that have XM radio or Sirius radio, you may know what we're talking about. Sometimes when you're driving down the freeway and you notice your radio drop out and you look up at the little window and it says accessing, that means there's a large cloud between you and the satellite, and the signal's having a hard time acquiring that little antenna you've got on the top of your car. That's what'll happen to us up there, because the cloud cover is almost perpetual. And the angle that we have to reach that satellite is acute. That means it's like looking over the horizon compared to what you're doing down here relatively close to the equator. So it is technologically a tough challenge. Can we meet it? I think so. But we have to be prepared.
Sure. Well, in that aspect, I would absolutely be happy to help jump in and see if I can be any help to you guys and assist you in that. If there was anything I could ever consider to, you know, to kind of throw myself into that actually made a difference, this would definitely be one of them.
Well,
and
that's cool.
I would be absolutely pleased to be a part of
you
guys.
Set up a lunch between you, me, and Michael Dell, and we'll put this whole project together in an afternoon.
Absolutely. I will absolutely do that.
All right, and we're talking to movie producers as well. I can't give out any names because it just wouldn't be ethical to shop that. But trust me, we're talking at very high levels because, you know, people don't experience expeditions like this by going on them themselves. I mean, people just don't raise $30,000 to go on a 13-day expedition, an extreme expedition. But they do watch the thing on DVD, or they do watch it on Discovery or History or National Geographic. But I can tell you definitively, because I've spoken personally with all three organizations, this is way beyond any cable channel documentary company. Discovery, History, and National Geographic couldn't even think about doing something of this scope. That doesn't mean they won't air the films. They probably will, but only after we get the voyage taken care of. However, there are feature film directors who do films with budgets like this, and they are interested in the scope and the possibility of discovery with this expedition. And that's the level of interest that we have in this project.
Well, that sounds great. That sounds great. I'm extremely excited to see what you guys are accomplishing and everything you've put together so far, and you know, I'm extremely excited to see what happens. Hopefully everything goes well, and you acquire the funding that you need to make this expedition, because I feel that it's extremely, extremely detrimental to what our knowledge of the world is right now. And I think that if it is a successful mission, I believe you guys will find something out there.
Well, it is that kind of belief, and it's the positive energy, and I say that in every possible spectrum that I can, that we receive from listeners to this program and readers of our books and watchers, viewers of our DVDs. It's that kind of consciousness, that kind of energy that will make us successful, and for that we are very, very grateful. Even you people, listeners that have never called in, you've never written, just the fact that you're thinking about it and that you're wishing us well and wishing us success, believe me, it's having its effect. And I want you to know that we have high levels of gratitude for that. You are not overlooked.
Well, that's incredible. Well, Dr. Agnews, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, and I look forward to visiting with you again on your voyage, and hopefully I'll have a chance to actually be a helper for NASA.
All right. Thank you, Jonathan, from Tulsa, Oklahoma. We appreciate you coming on the program. Have a good week. All right, my friends. We may have another caller on the line. Just want to make sure that if the lines have been open all night and so people kind of stack up. Do we have a caller on the line? Your first name, please. No. Okay. Well, I know they're stacking up. Just funnel them through one by one. We've got about 15 minutes left. In the final hour, this is a three-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, please let us know. Just contact us at info@x2-radio.com. Give us the call letters of your station, and we'll take care of the rest. We are definitely a proud member of the BBS Radio Network, and we are also streaming to you live on the SteelEye Media Network, thanks to Kevin Smith and his new network out there. And we're trying to expand the content of this program so that we can reach further and further out into the world and provide what appears to be the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. We approach it a little bit differently here. We try to stick with the science, not so much conspiracy theory. We don't do ghosts or anything like that. Plenty of people out there do it. We try to stick to the science and bring you the latest and greatest, sort of like a science channel on steroids. My AccuWindow forecast here in eastern Washington, it's cold. In fact, right now the water is frozen, so after the program I guess you know what I'll be doing. I wanted to give you a final little bit on William Henry's expedition, or not his expedition, but his recent trip to Egypt. He took an engineer, John Riley, with him, and 28 others of various disciplines to visit some of the not-so-visited places in Egypt. I'm not saying that they didn't do the touristy places like Luxor and Aswan Dam and, of course, the pyramids. Actually, there was an interesting report about that. They had an hour inside the Great Pyramid alone, just the group. And when they got back to the hotel, all of their room keys had been demagnetized. Interesting forces inside the Great Pyramid. We talked about the Osirian tonight. That's ancient, 9500 BC, ancient technology that was in Abydos, Egypt. We talked about Seti I of the 16th dynasty in Egypt that built his temple on the Osirian. We're not really sure why, because the Osirian at that time had long since been blown apart, and I mean blown apart. We're talking 48-inch square. This is the cross-section, a 48-inch cross-section of an 80-foot-long solid piece of red granite snapped like a twig and thrown hundreds of feet out into the desert. No carbon embed, so nobody dynamited this during World War II. This was done long, long time ago. Perhaps it was a power feedback, and perhaps the builders were just done with it and decided to deactivate it. Now, there's other speculation that perhaps they were successful in opening a stargate back there, 9500 BC,
and others came in and destroyed it to protect our planet, much the way that you might see on Stargate on the Science Fiction Channel. The fact that the Stargate was destroyed would not allow other races to come and populate our planet, but would allow us to evolve naturally, the way we're supposed to. One small technological step at a time, allowing our wisdom to just barely catch up with it. It seems that civilizations past have had a problem with that, that as their technology increases, their wisdom does not. They remain warlike. They remain selfish. They remain mentally, or at least socially, superior in their own eyes over others. And that creates conflict and has resulted in the annihilation of numerous civilizations on our planet. Hopefully, we're at that precipice again, but we have the wisdom, we have the ability to communicate globally, and communication and education may be the key to walking away from the abyss and surviving as a race, and perhaps rejoining the galactic community as the explorers we were meant to be. The evidence is there, my fellow Earth explorers. If you get a chance to go to Egypt, mark it down. Get yourself to Abydos. Get yourself to Dendera. Now, there is a fascinating one. Dendera is in rather poor repair right now. They are doing their best to clean it. They're scaffolding on the inside of it, and they're washing the soot left behind by conquerors past that has desecrated these areas by burning animals and burning wood and fires on the inside of these buildings, just literally coating the fantastic carvings and hieroglyphs on the inside of these buildings. Now, these travelers were able to go to Abydos, Dendera, Abu Ghraib, Aswan, Luxor, Edfu, Philae, all these fantastic temples, and guess what? At every single one of them, the hieroglyphs, the language of the hieroglyphs was identical. Do you know what that means? I can put two people together and I can have them write me a short paragraph in their own handwriting, and guess what? I can tell whose is whose by their handwriting. It is impossible to be able to tell the writer of the hieroglyphs going temple to temple, even through multiple dynasties. The hieroglyphs are identical in size, in proportion, in color, in depth, and they're carved into solid rock. We're not talking about writing on papyrus. We're talking about chiseling a relief into rock, carving away those things that don't belong and leaving what they do want to leave, and then coloring it with paint. And the paint lasted for over 2,000 years. That's amazing enough to be able to write a hieroglyph 1 inch or 2 inch or 3 inches tall. But how about the relief of Horus or Osiris or Ptah or Isis? Time after time, temple after temple, building after building, small scale, large scale, whether they're 30 foot tall or 3 feet tall. The proportions are identical. The skin texture, the head size, the length of the arms, the shape of the body, the clothing, the jewelry, everything carved into rock the same over and over and over again. Come on, people. It doesn't take a rocket scientist. Well, maybe it does take a rocket scientist. So you have one here trying to tell you the difficulty of not just carving into rock, but carving it the same over and over again. If you make a mistake in rock, there's no erasing it. You don't just grind it off and start over again. You'd have to redo the whole wall. And there are no chisel marks. There's no hammer marks. Everything is smooth, like it was laser etched into the stone. This is remarkable technology. a remarkable demonstration of technique and power and wisdom and an incredible urge, a drive, an insatiable drive to leave a record that would last for millions of years. Otherwise, they would have just written it on paper and let it blow away with the rest of their civilization. Did they think they would last for thousands of years? I think not. They were painfully aware of mortality, just like every human civilization. But they wanted their words, they wanted their technology, they wanted their understanding of the growth and the value of human life to last for a million years. And they did a darn good job of leaving it behind for us. Oh, did I say that? Yes, I did. They left it behind for us. They knew we would be coming, and they knew we would need what they knew. We would need what they learned. We would need the wisdom that they suffered through, that they were not able to survive. We would need it. Here we are, 8 years, maybe as little as 4 years away from a cosmic cataclysm that has been recorded 26,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, 700 years ago by civilizations past. Not just in Egypt, also in Guatemala, also in Mexico, also in North America. Race after race, society after society records the same thing, that we have to have our wits about us. We have to have a sense of mission about us. We have to have some sense of unity and tolerance and vision about us if we are going to survive. In no time past has any race been able to proliferate an idea as quickly and thoroughly as we can now. We have the ability to communicate globally, just like I am right now, all around the world. Millions of people will access this program and hopefully will have some introspection that no matter what they do, whether they're a computer analyst, a garbage collector, a doctor, a politician, or a president, they have, each of you, have profound effect on the group energy, the existence, the very creation of this universe, which we call our society, which we call our nation. We want you to be aware of that. Each day that you get up, each task that you do, do it with that in mind. And what you will realize day after day is that you are affecting the universe. In fact, the universe, as I have often said on this program, is the sum of the consciousness of all the sentient beings in it. Whether you are awake or whether you are asleep, whether you are conscious, unconscious, or just not conscious that you're conscious, you are affecting the universe. So we want you to do it on purpose. This year, 2008, we promise to bring you the best guests, the best interviews, the world's top authorities, to bring you the information that you need so that you can make day-to-day, moment-by-moment decisions, real decisions, not just about meditation, not just about what to buy or where to live or how to treat each other, how to consider yourself in the universe. Because ultimately and penultimately, it is the consideration that will save this race. Yes, it's important to consider your neighbor, but you can't consider your neighbor until you consider yourself. No one who loves himself can harm another. It is the primary commandment. It's the one by which we try to live here. We'll try to bring you the best information we can. Stick with us. We'll stick with you.
We're proud to be on BBS Radio. We're proud to be on the Steel Eye Media Network. And we want you to realize that you are the focus of this program. We appreciate you here on X Squared Radio. Please visit our affiliates. Keep us, keep the lights on. Help our affiliates to keep their lights on. And if you feel an urge to get involved with the Inner Earth Expedition, you know how to do it. Just go to the website, go to the online store. There are lots of ways to participate. We appreciate you, my friends. We will see you next week here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.